Good afternoon, and welcome to the second of a three-part webinar series on Great Decisions, America in the World. I'm Michael Oslin of the Hoover Institution. This series grew out of a project that Hoover ran with the Foreign Policy Association this year to produce a special edition of Great Decisions on the most important foreign policy challenges facing America and the next president. I acted as co-editor of this volume, along with the president of the Foreign Policy Association, and I worked with 10 of my Hoover colleagues who wrote essays on the challenges facing the president according to their expertise. Last time, we talked about critical countries, and today we're going to be talking about strategic stability. I'm thrilled to be joined by three of my colleagues, eminent scholars and prolific authors. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. Neil Ferguson is the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and for 12 years was the Lawrence Tisch Professor of History at Harvard. And Victor Davis Hansen is the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, a specialist on the classical world and a renowned military historian. We're going to have a conversation amongst ourselves today. It's going to be fairly informal. Before I start, where each of my colleagues will talk a little bit about the essays that they wrote, let me remind you that if you'd like to ask questions, you can use the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen, and I will be moderating those later. We're going to start off with Neil, who's going to talk about geopolitics. We'll then move to Larry, who's going to talk about the challenges facing democracy. And batting cleanup will be Victor, who will turn it all into what foreign policy for the president should be. So Neil, let's start with you. This has been, by some measures, an annus terribilis. It's certainly a year that none of us will forget. But to paraphrase from the movie The Producers with that Mel Brooks put out 50 years ago, today Germany, tomorrow the world, Die Welt. Let's talk about Die Welt a little bit. What are the great geopolitical tectonic trends that are reshaping the world today and that the next president is going to have to deal with?
Well, Misha, thank you very much indeed for inviting me to participate in this session. If you haven't read my contribution to this volume, let me simply summarize the argument. The argument is that the defining strategic reality of our time is Cold War II, and that for American foreign policy, the first thing that is indispensable is for us to come out of denial that we're in a second Cold War. And I see that denial really very widely spread, not only through academia, but in the Democratic Party. And it must be said among some Republicans too. So what I want to do in the opening minutes of this session is just to explain why I think we're in Cold War II and why the events of 2020 have intensified that Cold War, revealed it to many people around the world, as well as in the United States, if they hadn't already noticed it, and created an altogether new strategic situation for the next administration, which does indeed seem very likely to be led by Joe Biden. There will be no way, as far as I can see, for a Biden administration to turn the clock back to 2016 or to any of the years of the Obama administration. There will be no way to turn the clock back to what I used to call Chimerica, when it seemed as if China and the United States were in a kind of symbiotic relationship. The Chinese used to talk about a win-win partnership. It only gradually became apparent to Americans that China was going to do the winning. So let me sketch out why I think this is a second Cold War. It's not such a counterintuitive notion. After all, there was a First World War and then there was a second. They weren't identical, but nobody really disagreed about the nomenclature. And in the same way, Cold War I and Cold War II aren't identical, but they're sufficiently the same, I think, to deserve to be Cold Wars. Now, obviously, there are differences. China's the principal antagonist, this time not the Soviet Union. There's a much higher level of economic interdependence between the US and China than was ever the case between the US and the Soviet Union. There was never Amerussia the way there was Chimerica. China's economy is much bigger than the Soviets ever got. By one measure, China's caught up with the United States, purchasing power parity adjusted GDP. The Soviets never got close. There's much more cultural interchange today between the US and China than there ever was between the US and the Soviet Union. Just think of all the Chinese students at US colleges, and think of all the members of the Chinese elite who studied at elite universities in the United States in recent years. It's worth adding that technology's changed, so it's actually much harder for each side in Cold War II to conceal what it's up to from the other side. It's also much easier for the Chinese to access private and public American data. It's true that China's not promoting a socialist revolution around the world. It's true that China doesn't control a significant number of neighboring states as the Soviet Union did in Eastern Europe. I don't think there'll be nuclear brinkmanship. I don't expect proxy wars. But having said all that, I think the two Cold Wars have a great deal in common. Even the basic geopolitical arrangements familiar. As in the early years of the first Cold War, it's the US and its allies up against China, Russia, and North Korea. It's just that China's the leading partner now. Like the Soviet Union, China's engaged and has been engaged for years in systematic technological catch-up, using espionage to acquire Western technology. As in Cold War I, there's an arms race in multiple technological fields. In Cold War I, it was principally nuclear weapons and space, but it was also information warfare, biological and chemical weapons, whereas today China's seeking parity in software, in hardware, in artificial intelligence, in quantum computing, and of course, even in vaccines, though I think they seem to have been thoroughly beaten, at least in that domain. Like the Soviet Union, China has both regional and global ambitions. Regionally, it seeks predominance in East Asia. It's turning the South China Sea into a vast naval base, as Misha Ostler knows very well. Globally, its One Belt, One Road initiative looks a lot like the way the Soviets used to operate around the world, with aid and infrastructure in return for political loyalty. Like the Soviet Union, the Chinese have no compunction about bankrolling corrupt regimes like Venezuela's. But I think the thing I'd emphasize, because it's the thing that most Americans are still, as far as I can see, in denial about, is that like the Soviet Union, China has an ideological objective, which is to curb the spread of Western ideas like representative government and the rule of law. And when you listen to the things that Xi Jinping has said in recent years and look at the language that he's used, it's very strikingly familiar to any student of the Cold War. He's talked in recent speeches about struggle, duzhong, I'll probably mangle the Chinese words, great struggle, wei da duzhong, and struggle for a new era, fen du xin shi dai. That's terminology we haven't really heard from a Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. China's a one-party state. It's got a leadership that's increasingly overtly committed to the Marxist-Leninist view of both internal power and international relations. It's building a system of surveillance more comprehensive and intrusive than anything George Orwell imagined in 1984. It uses repressive methods like mass internment, re-education, and population control against internal minorities like the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. It's ending the semi-autonomy of Hong Kong as we speak, and it has designs on ending the de facto democracy and independence of Taiwan. And of course, it's engaged in an arms race with the United States, just in the same way as the Soviet Union was, a naval arms race and a missile arms race, which has eroded in recent years American naval predominance in East Asia, or what we now call the Indo-Pacific. Finally, it's worth adding that China, like the Soviet Union, only worse, is an environmental health hazard to the rest of the world. I think we should think of COVID-19 as a kind of super Chernobyl, causing far more external damage than the great Chernobyl nuclear disaster did, extending not just to the regions around where the Chernobyl power plant was, but in the case of COVID-19, all around the world, and inflicting a vastly higher death toll than the Chernobyl disaster did. And yet I think one day we'll come to see that the pathologies that brought about the COVID-19 pandemic in the months of December last year and January this year were very similar to the pathologies that brought about the Chernobyl disaster. So for me, the key feature of the world in 2020 is that Cold War II is now harder and harder to miss. It's very striking this year, as Pew Research showed just a month or two ago, that sentiment on China, not only in the United States, but also in many developed countries, indeed almost all developed countries, and some important developing economies like India's, has turned massively negative. And I think this will, for future historians, be one of the most striking legacies of the Trump administration. It's, of course, very fashionable now to heap opprobrium on President Trump, but I think he played a very important role in changing the direction of US policy towards China, bringing an end to the delusions of the late Obama period, which amounted to a kind of acquiescence in Chinese ascendancy in the name of strategic patience. And although Trump himself didn't use the language of Cold War, preferring the language of trade war, I think one could see that Cold War II had begun when Vice President Pence gave his speech at the Hudson Institute in October of 2018, greatly broadening out the scope of the Chinese challenge as he defined it. So, Misha, I think I'll leave it there because there are obviously a great many other issues that I could touch upon, not least the changing landscape in the Middle East, the transatlantic relationship. But to me, these are all ultimately secondary to the leitmotif of Cold War II.
Neil, thank you. I appreciate that because we want ultimately to get to a hierarchy of problems that a president's going to face. We're going to come back in round two, ask you some more questions, but I'd like to turn to Larry. Now, for those of you who've been Hoover webinar regulars, you've undoubtedly been following what Larry's been doing on two projects related to China, the China's Global Sharp Power Project and also the Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific project. So it would be a natural segue from Neil into Larry. But Larry, I want to ask you about democracy. I want to ask you about the things that you've been working on for so long. And they're not unrelated to what Neil was talking about. And in fact, in round two, I'd like to try to link them together. But starting with first steps, what does a president face, the next president, assuming again it's going to be Joe Biden, face in terms of strengthening, protecting, defending, encouraging democracy abroad? You've written for a long time about the democracy deficit, the democracy recession. What's the balance sheet today? What do they need to know going forward?
Well, thank you, Misha. And first of all, what they need to know is everything that Neil just so eloquently said. Neil, thank you for stating it so forcefully and eloquently, and I would say memorably. The only thing I have a slight disagreement with is, Neil, I think has heard this before, I think as a practical matter, we will be better off rallying a global coalition and we will be better off rallying a domestic consensus if we don't call it Cold War II. But I agree with Neil, that's pretty much what it is. And I think it's such a powerful phenomenon and such a threat to our values and our national security and to the future of freedom in the world, that there is a growing prospect for a global coalition, and not a perfect. I share some of Neil's concerns about some of the energy and progress eroding in the next administration, but I'm optimistic. But I think we've made a lot of progress toward a bipartisan resolve to address this, I would say, existential challenge to our national security and to freedom in the world. And so, Misha, there's no pivot here. It's a natural segue, everything Neil said, into what I want to say. And I'll make it with the following brief bullet points. First of all, we've been in a democratic recession in the world for about 12, 14, 15 years now. It's been subtle, very incremental for most of the last decade and a half, but it's definitely gathering momentum in recent years. And it's not a coincidence that this is happening at the same time that American power and resolve have been ebbing in the world, and that China has been surging in its global ambitions and its global power, and Russia as well. The two are flip sides of the same coin, and I think represent the changing nature of the geostrategic balance of power that Neil precisely diagnosed. And so now I'll just kind of invert the perspective and put the positive spin on it, that if we are an institution that stands for economic and political freedom and human dignity, and if we believe that affirming that and defending that has to be a major element of American foreign policy. Of course, it can't be the only one. We live in the real world where we have practical security needs in a variety of places. But if we believe that rallying a de facto alliance against that and standing up for freedom in the world is in our paramount national interest, then we have to see the fundamental point that is both, I think, one of the key insights of Samuel Huntington's book, The Third Wave, Democratization in the Late 20th Century, and was one of the key insights of the Ronald Reagan presidency, that if I can put it this crudely, it's about power. And if we lose a situation in which the world's leading democracy is not the most powerful country in the world, and in which the alliance of democracies, particularly the transatlantic alliance, but I would say now, a trans-Pacific or Indo-Pacific alliance that draws together Japan, the United States, Korea, Australia, to some extent India, though there are some complexities there we could talk about. And of course, maybe not in quite an overt way, but certainly in a working way, Taiwan as well, which will be on the front lines of the battle. I think the next test for freedom in the world is going to be what happens to Taiwan. And I think China lusts for Taiwan the way Hitler lusted for Czechoslovakia. And if China, the Beijing Communist Party leadership, squeezes, subdues, and absorbs Taiwan the way Hitler squeezed, lured the world into believing he only had partial ambitions, and then swallowed Czechoslovakia, I think that we're on the same glide path toward a global disaster as we were back then. And I hope we will learn, we will have learned the lessons of, if I can use the word, because I think it's a relevant word again in world history, and I think Victor may have something more to say about it, appeasement. So I think that the first point to be made when you're talking about freedom and democracy and their future in the world is that we must restore American global power and the power of our alliances, and therefore fight, particularly China, but I would also say Russia's ambitions to project hard power and particularly global sharp power, which is what we've been studying, Misha, as you know, in the project you mentioned on China's global sharp power. Its efforts, in the words of the former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, to project power that is covert, coercive, or corrupting, and usually it's all three, to penetrate our universities, our think tanks, our mass media, our local governments, to pressure their Chinese students into reporting on one another and try and isolate them from the free flow of ideas that would open them up to new possibilities and send them back to aspire for democratic change within China. This is the first imperative. The second that follows naturally from it is that, therefore, we have to wage a battle of ideas. It's not just about power. It's about a positive vision in which the kinds of principles and analyses that we've been working on at Hoover and others around the world for limited government and human freedom and internet freedom and so on get promoted around the world. This is why I think we need to relaunch the U.S. Information Agency as a robust and independent instrument to promote principles and ideas of freedom, democracy, human rights, and the dangers of what China's trying to do in the world, why we need to disperse these ideas around the world in innovative ways, both by providing new means of scaling internet censorship and helping people to evade the kinds of censorship that China is trying to promote and trying to stop China from being able to expand its reach with the Huawei system of 5G telecommunications infrastructure. And really try and promote these values and ideas in innovative ways. Finally, I'll end by saying that we need to regenerate diplomacy for democracy. And this is very tricky because we live, as I said, in a real world where we have alliances that are practical and allies that don't fully share our values, particularly in the Middle East. But there's always things we can do privately and things we need to do publicly to try and lure them and encourage them in a better direction and stand up for freedom and human rights. And obviously, we need a close working relationship, just for example, with the Egyptian government. It's an important ally in the region, but General al-Sisi has just embarked upon a new campaign of arrests of independent, you know, human rights and civic activists, the kind of people that we believe in and want to work with to promote ideas defining a free society. And I think we have leverage we can use to stand up for those people.
Larry, thank you. I definitely want to come back to a number of the things that you raised and link it with some of the things that Neil had talked about. But I'd like to move to our cleanup batter now, Victor. You know, so we've had two very big, broad, I mean, the roads all led to Beijing, but two very big, broad views of what's going on in the world, the challenges. But ultimately, we have to have a policy, and the president has to come up with a policy. So, Victor, your essay for this volume was on foreign policy broadly writ for the U.S. president. Given everything that Neil, Larry has talked about, but beyond that, what are the great challenges that are that have to be answered in a foreign policy by, again, it appears to be a Biden administration?
Well, due to time limits, I'll confine myself to three very quickly: China and the Middle East and our relations with our traditional ally, Europe. But I would say that Joe Biden, we have to separate what Donald Trump said and the style in which he engaged in foreign policy and the actual concrete record that he achieved. And that's important to remember because that will guide the Joe Biden administration if he were to be ratified, as it looks like it's likely. I would say that you can't say that the present policy is isolationist. You don't have isolationists that have 225,000 troops deployed around the globe or 30,000 diplomatic personnel or have increased the defense budget by $80 billion. So whatever Trump said, if you actually look at his record, whether bombing ISIS out of temporary existence or fighting four more years in Afghanistan, he wasn't the isolationist, he was caricatured. But turning to China, there were two great myths that he absolutely exploded. And the first was, and I don't know where it got currency other than the George H.W. administration, who started it, I guess. But the idea was the more a country becomes wealthy and affluent and capitalist, the more democratic by fate it becomes. There was no evidence from that necessarily in the Arab world. There was no evidence for it in the 1930s with the German economy or the Japanese economy or the Italian. There's no evidence in Latin America. And often the opposite is true. The more facilities it has to exercise authoritarian leverage on its own people and its neighbors. So he blew that up. He said, the more you treat China and you appease it, that magnanimity is going to be looked at as weakness to be exploited, not to be reciprocated in kind. The second thing he said, there's no way in the world that we have to accept this Communist Party Congress prediction that in 30, 40 years, it's going to be the world's hegemony. And people had almost thought it was like the British handover of imperial power after World War II to the Americans. It was going to be fated. And Trump said some things that we all knew, but we just didn't want to say it. He said, they've got 1.4 billion people. We have 330, and yet we have twice the GDP they do. How can that be if one American worker produces twice the goods and services? You look at all the ratings of the top universities, we're 18 out of the top 20. We're the world's greatest exporter of food. We're the greatest producer of energy, gas and oil, et cetera, et cetera. We have the largest military in the world, best everything. So it was kind of chauvinistic and blunderbuss, but it was true. So he said it was a crisis of confidence and we have to disabuse ourselves that China's going to take over. And then what he did was, in a weird way, despite his divisive rhetoric, he created a policy that united various factions. So the interior of the country that had been wiped out by asymmetrical trade, Chinese violations systematically of patents, trademark, copyright, dumping, currency manipulation, technological appropriation, all of that, he said, had unduly hurt the losers of globalizations in the interior of the country. And he was going to look at outsourcing and offshoring and symmetrical trade and use the T word tariff. So that got a lot of center right middle class people, but he also gave leeway for people who said, you know what, if we're going to confront China, let's talk about the Uyghurs. Let's talk about the destruction of Hong Kong democracy as we must. Let's talk about what the genocide that's taking place through some of the Muslim populations, the destruction of Tibetan culture, the racism that is evident in the treatment of African students and visitors during the COVID crisis. So it was an umbrella policy that allowed a lot of different players. And that suggests to me that when Biden looks at China, he may say, we're going to have a detente or whatever, but he's not going to be able, I think, to go back to the Mike Bloomberg Stan Paulson, Bob, you know, the Microsoft, the Gates idea that we're all going to have detente, we're all going to get wealthy, and the Davos Aspen crowd knows what's best for everybody on China. So that's a real achievement. I think it's going to be developed by Biden, and we'll probably see something to criticize the rhetoric of Trump, even call it racist or whatever. But when you actually look at the nuts and bolts, it'll be a continuation of what Neil talked about and Larry too. When you look at the Middle East, it was a complete recalibration. And that was made possible by some things that we hadn't appreciated in this country. In other words, we are now the largest producer of gas and oil, the largest exporter of gas. Israel is completely independent in gas and oil. In contrast, China depends on about 30% of its needs, energy needs in the Middle East. It provides 50% of the of its exports into the Middle East. 50% of the imports, I should say, from the Middle East come from China. And the EU relies on about 40%. So what he was saying was, this area is central to the world, but it's optional to the United States in a way. And that gave us a lot of latitude. So when we got out of this Iran deal and we stopped subsidizing Hezbollah and Hamas and the disruption in Lebanon and the Assad genocidal regime, and at the same time we upped the sanctions and the COVID hit and world oil prices crashed, for the first time in my memory, this Iranian theocracy is in real trouble. And it hasn't alleviated or mitigated its rhetoric. So it's the weaker it gets, the tinier the stick, the louder the rhetoric. And that has created, I think inadvertently, the Obama administration created the environment in which the moderate sheikdoms in the Persian Gulf and other parts of the Arab world look toward Israel as an ally and said, you know what, you're a nuclear power. We have no problem with that. And it came from the Arab countries said the Palestinians are not central anymore to a Middle East peace. We can have a detente between us and common alliance against Iran and check its terrorist adventurism and its efforts to overturn governments in the region and turn toward economic development of Palestine, the West Bank, and that will take a life of its own. And that's where we are. And all of a sudden, we see these strange alliances. Iran seems weaker than it ever has. And I think Joe Biden will say, we have to get in the Iran deal. We have to get in the Iran deal. But when he starts listening to people in the Arab world and he sees what the situation is and what Iran's historical stance has been toward us, its use of terrorist appendages all over the world to kill Americans, I think he will praise the Iran deal, but not go back into it and let the current evolutionary process continue and probably take credit for it if he's wise. And finally, very quickly, Trump is most criticized because of his harsh rhetoric to Europe. And he was harsh in a lot of references to NATO. But if you actually look at NATO now, militarily, it's much stronger because more, not fewer, of its member states have tried to meet the 2% investment of GDP in defense. We have a much bigger defense budget. We're much more capable of running NATO. But both George W. Bush, especially Barack Obama, I remember he called them free riders, had been jawboning NATO to contribute, but they never listened. And Trump comes along and he knows one thing, and that is whatever Germany does, most of NATO will do. Our European partners. It runs NATO economically. Whether it's influence with the southern Mediterranean debt states or on immigration with Eastern Europe or the conditions of Brexit, it runs things. And here we have this anomaly of the largest country in Europe, which, by the way, in the latest Pew poll, polls the lowest favorability of Americans. And this was not a phenomenon just the Trump. It went down during the Trump era, but during the Obama years, they expressed the greatest dislike of any country in Europe. And here they were not meeting their 2% contributions, and they were jawboning others not to meet it. And they were asking Americans to pick up 33% of the tab and 18-year-old kids from Ohio to go be stationed in Germany, why they cut a $10 billion gas deal with a nominal chief threat to the European alliance, Putin. So it was something that was out, you know, it's just not sustainable on its logic, and nobody wanted to say anything because of the illustrious history of NATO and the transatlantic alliance. But I think what's going to happen now, Biden will come in, as in the case of the Middle East and Russia and China, and he will say, you know, I'm a team player and we've got to work on our alliances. And I didn't like what Donald Trump did. But by the way, I do think this is an unsustainable situation. And I'm a sober and judicious interlocutor. And so in the proverbial Western, somebody, you know, is called in to solve problems that seemed intractable or to recalibrate the relationship between the sodbusters and the cattle barons. And when he starts to do that, he has methodologies and rhetoric that offend people and he has to write off it. But the actual policy, I think, will stay the same.
Victor, thank you. If you're just joining us, I'm Michael Auslan. Welcome to a second in a series of webinars on Great Decisions, America in the World. Those were fantastic overviews from each of you. I appreciate them. I'd like to move into round two, which will start getting into audience questions. Remind the audience, if you do have questions, you can use the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen. Neil, I'd like to come back to you and actually ask you about something that Larry mentioned. I mean, Larry warned that if the largest democracy or the, you know, the most powerful democracy in the world, America, does not remain the most powerful, then we're going to be in trouble, not only at home but around the world, and it's going to affect everything from alliances to our ability to project power. And I'm you know, reading into a little bit of what he said. But it's the question of power I actually want to ask you about, national power. You've written and you've talked a lot about the tech side of this. Can you talk a little bit in terms of the geopolitical, the question of stability and the geopolitical trends? First of all, what can we do and what threats do we face by no longer being the chief producer of semiconductor chips, of not having the most robust R&D ecosystem, let alone investment? What does the next president have to do to resolve that, or what should he at least be thinking about?
Well, Misha, one of the reasons that I've used the term Cold War II, even though Larry thinks it's not very diplomatic of me, is that we need the same kind of awareness of the threat to make the investments and take the steps necessary to magnify American power where it needs to be magnified. I think Victor is right that there'll be significant continuity in practice between the Trump and Biden administrations, though they will never admit that, particularly on the China issue. I thought it was very striking that Michel Flournoy, who's widely regarded as a sure thing for the Secretary of Defense position, published a piece in Foreign Affairs earlier this year arguing that we needed to increase our credible military commitment to Taiwan and indeed to the freedom of navigation in the South China Sea to deter China from considering an amphibious invasion. I actually think we might find that a Biden administration is more hawkish on traditional geopolitical or military naval issues than the Trump administration was. But of course, power is not just about aircraft carriers and the missiles that can now sink them. Because of the transformation of information technology, power is also about hardware and about software. Now, you mentioned semiconductors. This is China's Achilles heel because China spends more importing high-end semiconductors than it spends importing oil from the Middle East. And those semiconductors come partly from the United States, partly from Europe, and partly from right next door in Taiwan, where TSMC has established itself as the leading cutting-edge producer of semiconductors. China will have to spend an awful lot of money to catch up with TSMC. Of course, that is Xi Jinping's goal. It has been a goal of China's economic policy for some time. But as somebody said to me in Taipei back in January, the Chinese are 5 years behind us, but they were 5 years behind us 5 years ago, and they will be 5 years behind us 5 years from now. It's a major challenge that China may not actually be able to meet, because it really is some distance away from being able to get close to the very, very high-end semiconductor manufacturers that their companies, including most obviously Huawei, desperately need. What happened this year, which didn't get quite as much coverage as it needed to get, was that the Commerce Department imposed new restrictions that essentially cut Huawei off from TSMC and other companies that manufacture these high-end semiconductors. Because if they use even intellectual property from the United States, they cannot trade with PRC companies such as Huawei. The Chinese government has been very quiet about this because it did not want to make itself an issue in the US election. Notice, if China had been a bigger issue in the election, it would have been very difficult for Joe Biden, who at the beginning of his campaign said some very foolishly soft things on the China question. And of course, as Victor rightly says, on this issue, Trump has really led and built a bipartisan coalition, indeed built almost a global coalition against China. So it was important for the Chinese to keep a very low profile during the crucial weeks running up to the November 3rd election. But that issue is not going away, for the obvious reason that China can solve its semiconductor problem in a matter of 24 hours if it successfully can invade and take over Taiwan. So I do think this is the kind of issue that we need to pay very close attention to. Let me add one more thing. If China's behind on semiconductors, it is ahead on payment platforms and digital currency. The United States has been very small c conservative on these issues because the Federal Reserve and the US Treasury like the system we currently have, where the fiat currency dollar is the dominant reserve currency and the dominant trade currency, and you pay internationally through something called SWIFT, an interbank payment system that dates back many decades. Because we like this system, not least because it allows us to impose financial sanctions, we're very, very reluctant to see innovation. But innovation is happening in fintech and in digital currency, and the Chinese are at the cutting edge of it. And so that's where they actually are, I think, ahead. And although the challenge to the dollar isn't one that's going to manifest itself next year, over a 10-year time horizon, I think America has to be worried, and the Biden administration has to be worried, that Chinese payment platforms will ultimately be handling an ever larger share of transactions. And that will imperceptibly erode the dominance of the dollar over, let's say, a 10-year time horizon.
Thank you. It bleeds into the question of overall R&D, and there's been calls and even some bills in Congress to refund on the level of a Cold War program R&D because of the spillover when you're whatever is being thought about is not ultimately what you wind up with. You wind up with lots of other unforeseen technologies that have consumer applications as well as military applications, financial applications in this case. And so it's an interesting question about really, there is a Cold War mindset, but there's different types of the Cold War that, you know, that we could talk about even with Larry's caveat. And Larry, I want to turn to you. We have a question from Jeffrey. And it goes directly to things that you've been working about. We've touched on it a little, but I think it'd be useful if you could talk to us more directly about the question of Taiwan, Hong Kong, the Uyghurs. Jeffrey asks, how likely is it that China will launch an invasion of Taiwan? And would that action be another Crimea, meaning a fait accompli that generated lots of hand-wringing and ineffective economic sanctions, so that it would be a move on the chessboard of Cold War III, as opposed to Hot War III? Michael asks along with that, what can we do about Hong Kong? There was another question about the Uyghurs, saying when we had a chance to do something about the Uyghurs, even raise the issue, we more or less punted. So where do we stand with all of this, with what's happening in Hong Kong, what's happened to the Uyghurs, but most importantly, in a way, is it leading towards something that's going to be very ugly with Taiwan?
Well, thank you, Misha. I think the first thing we need is very robust statements and diplomacy and projection of our principles. And this is where we get the interface both with diplomacy and public diplomacy. You know, one of the interesting things that's happened, and one of the hopeful things that happened, because I spent a lot of time looking at global public opinion data, is that China's standing in the world with ordinary people has declined significantly in the last 5 years. A lot of people would like the Chinese system of rapid economic growth, but they don't want the Chinese system of Orwellian surveillance, and they don't want Chinese bullying of them geopolitically, and they don't want China sending them into a debt trap that China leverages to take over their ports and other critical technology. So this is something that we have as leverage that we can use and build upon to mobilize global outrage and global sympathy. And certainly there are a lot of Muslim people in the world, including among our allies in the Middle East. And I think there's a lot we have to work with to mobilize outrage against what they've done in Xinjiang province, which I think can only be described, building on what my two distinguished colleagues have already said, as a crime against humanity. And I think we need to start using that kind of language. Secondly, I favor Magnitsky-style economic sanctions, targeted personal economic sanctions against the Hong Kong elite and some of the Beijing elite that are perpetrating this destruction of human rights and violation of China's treaty-like commitment under the Sino-British Joint Declaration to preserve one country, two systems, at least, you know, for 50 years until 2047. I mean, they couldn't even wait that long to execute the Marxist-Leninist playbook. I do want to say parenthetically in this regard, Misha, that we will have an event today at 4 p.m., a Hoover event on the end of One Country, Two Systems with the great scholar of Hong Kong, Victoria Wei, and the Democratic youth activist, Nathan Law. If anyone wants to join, they can go to the Hoover website. Then with respect to Taiwan, I think what Flournoy and others have proposed, it's becoming a very broad sense of resolve now that we must forward deploy more power in the region militarily. But our own beloved colleague, Admiral James Ellis, Jim Ellis, will tell you he commanded the first of those aircraft carrier battle groups, the Independence Group, to get to the Strait of Taiwan in the last major crisis in 1996 when Clinton sent two aircraft carrier battle groups. It's a different story now, as we've already heard, with the range of Chinese anti-ship missiles. And so we not only need more forward deployment, but we need to think about it in new ways. And I'd say we need new kinds of deterrence, and we need to bolster Taiwan's ability to use asymmetric military means, digital and otherwise, to repel Chinese military intentions. Let me conclude by saying this about Taiwan. In August of last year, when China was massing security forces near the border with Hong Kong, I was worried that they were about to send in troops to crush the Hong Kong protests. They didn't do so. I actually think it was a ruse back then. It was intimidation that they didn't intend to do so. And they settled, having learned the lesson of massacring 3,000 people on the streets of Beijing in 1989 in Tiananmen Square, probably more. I think they learned the lesson that, you know, a bloodbath is probably not the best approach. And incremental strangulation is a smarter one. And that's what they're doing now in Hong Kong. And I think incremental strangulation is what they intend for Hong Kong, for Taiwan as well. I worry that they might seize militarily some of the outer islands, even ones that have nobody on them, and then start squeezing the airspace and maritime access in Taiwan. And we need to be prepared to act very vigorously and, even dare the PRC to fire upon us if they would be so imprudent to do so. And this is going to require not just the deployment of more and imaginatively arrayed military force in the region, not necessarily just aircraft carrier battle groups, and more effort to strengthen Taiwan's defense. It's going to require winning the technological race to ensure that the United States remains overwhelmingly militarily superior. And that means a very hard push on artificial intelligence, on blocking China's theft of our high technology, on quantum computing, and so many other things where China is trying to steal our high and militarily relevant technology.
You mentioned the incremental squeezing of Taiwan, the incremental squeezing of Hong Kong, and sometimes those increments increase dramatically. And we saw that just last week with the expulsion of four democracy lawmakers from the Legislative Council in Hong Kong, and then the walkout of the rest of the democratic, non-Beijing allied Legislative Council, so that the council, the Legislative Council now is an open field for Beijing. So there are these moments of quick change, and that certainly is what happened. And thank you for reminding at 4 o'clock again today, 4 o'clock that specific time, so it'll be 7 o'clock Eastern time. The talk on Hong Kong, go to the Hoover website, part of Larry's program on China's global sharp power. Victor, I'd like to turn to you, and I also, of course, welcome my colleagues to respond to each other. But Victor, in your recent book, The Second World Wars, one of the things that I took away from it was the extraordinary, globe girdling effort that the United States made with allies, and you go through industrial production, obviously you go through strategic planning, you go through manpower, you covered all of it in terms of showing what was needed to defeat the greatest threat to global civilization up to that point in time. We've talked a little bit about alliances today, but I'm wondering if I could ask you in a global mindset again, to talk about our alliances. The alliances are historically abnormal that we have in that they've been open-ended, multi-generational alliances, as opposed to more shorter-term, almost transactional alliances. Are these alliances the alliances that we need going forward to deal with China, to deal with Russia, North Korea, and Iran? Do we have to rethink the alliances, tweak them? What does a next president have to think about this long struggle that we're in from the alliance perspective?
The problem with every alliance is one thing historically from antiquity to the present, and that is if a member of the alliance is not proximate to its benefactor, but on the front lines, is the benefactor willing to take an optional military choice to protect it, whether it's Plataea in ancient Athens or whether it's Czechoslovakia and Britain and France? So what we did is we expanded NATO without consideration of that fact. We didn't ask ourselves, is somebody in Florence having coffee that's 19 years old, is he ready to, get a helmet and go all the way over to Lithuania? Or is, in the case of China, are South Koreans willing to come to the aid of Taiwanese? And we haven't answered those questions. Getting to China specifically, the problem we're having, as Larry mentioned, with Taiwan is it doesn't quite have the same relationship with us, and I think it should, as others do. What I mean by that is if North Korea moves on South Korea, if China moves on Japan, if China moves on Australia, there's no doubt what the United States is going to do. It might not want to publicize it, but it's going to say that Sydney is as sacrosanct as San Francisco, and it's under our nuclear umbrella, probably so. That's not true of Taiwan, and China knows that. And I think that was a mistake way back, but you've given some other facts of the last few years. During the appeasement of 2009 and to 16, we let them take the Spratly Islands without much objection. There were intrusions into air and sea space among our allies. We didn't react promptly, and we distanced ourselves from Taiwan. And China has it in their head that if we go into Taiwan, there's probably not going to be a response that has been explained and codified among the American people. So you say the average American, do you want to go to war with nuclear China over Taiwan? They're probably going to say no, in a way they would say yes if they have to save Japan or Australia. And that has to be clarified. Second thing is you have these tensions and a change of transition from administration to administration. So here we have the situation where Trump is disliked by the diplomatic community. We've had a revolt of the retired generals. He's had changes in the Pentagon, National Security Staff, where the MAGA agenda doesn't quite jive with the military diploma intelligence complex. And the perception abroad is that in this transition, there's a lot of uncertainty on the United States what its traditional roles is. And then you combine that with a contested election, and it's still contested. And then you combine it with a perception that Joe Biden is 78 and has not been muscular during the campaign and may have lapses of cognitive issues, we don't know. And he has fissures within that government. And you put all of this into this matrix that it is a dangerous time right now until we get back on track and we get a unified policy on China. And what we want to do with China and what we can do with China, Larry mentioned the problematic issue of stationing advanced forces close to the Chinese coast. We can't do that with safety. By the same token, we haven't made penicillin in the country since 2004. We're completely vulnerable still on pharmaceuticals and key industries, and we don't have the STEM engineers to decouple like the way that we would like to. So we're going to have sort of a Marshall Plan of training the necessary personnel in all of these key military, computer, research, pharmaceutical industries to give us autonomy vis-a-vis China. And then finally, I'd like just to think that I think we might have the COVID threat a little wrong. I think in the beginning, China was embarrassed because of its non-transparency, its culpability, its shenanigans with the World Health Organization, whatever the relationship was with their Wuhan lab versus the live market. We don't know the origins of the virus. We don't know exactly what China's role was. But early in the epidemic, they said to us, okay, we're kind of culpable. They took a lot of heat. And then the second stage was, but you know what? We're going to never let this crisis go to waste. And they started jacking up the price of protective equipment. They put conditions on export. They reminded us they could cut off our farm. And it was more of a defiant. Now they feel that they have taken a crisis and not just come out okay, but they think it's in their, it's a positive development in a way, if I could use that term over such a tragic situation. By that, I mean, they think, well, wait a minute, now we look at it very carefully and we have an authoritarian government that can track our citizens without civil liberties. We can lock down whole countries. We can do whatever we want with vaccinations and rush them in with, you know, we can always use waivers if we have to try to a vaccine. They think they have advantages in these sort of crises. And they're reminding people that they're going to do things that the corrupt democratic West, they think, can't do. And what I'm getting at is their attitude, if you start reading what they're saying, is something like this. We don't know how to start it. You want to accuse us of it? Maybe you're right. And maybe it spread. And maybe there was a SARS-1. And maybe there's a SARS-2. But you know what? It could get out again. There could be a SARS-3. But if there is a SARS-3, we know one thing, it's going to destroy your civilization much more effectively than it is going to be ours. And we're going to have a deniability of culpability just like we do now. And that is an enormous deterrent to us, because right now we're thinking, this, as Neil said, this thing did a lot more damage in Chernobyl. It did more damage than anything during the Cold War. And we're sitting here thinking we're going to jawbone China and make them culpable, but we don't have the infrastructure yet in key industries or the military clout to back up that rhetoric. And yet they're telling us, we didn't make, maybe even if we didn't plan this, it turns out that this was so much more effective than anything Russia did in the Cold War. And why we're not going to deliberately do it again, we can't rule out the fact that it might accidentally on purpose leak, and you don't seem to have a response like we do. And so I'm really worried about that, because it's a very dangerous time, both during the transition and the circumstances in which China has now, in its third phase of recalibrating the virus, seems to hit on something that's very scary to not only the efforts to democratize and human rights in China and the world in general, but also our national security in a realist sense of deterrent.
We've talked a lot about China. Obviously, we're basically out of time. We have a lot of questions on Latin America, Africa, and the like. I'd just like to ask one last quick question, if everyone would be willing to stick around for a few more seconds. I'd like to go back to much earlier in Neil's career, where he wrote a book about essentially counterfactual history, what if history, what didn't happen, and if you re-envisioned history in certain ways. We've talked, as I said, a lot about China. We've talked about Russia. We've talked about alliances. I'd like to ask each of you very briefly to wrap up today, since the topic of today is strategic stability. Thinking outside of those that we've covered today, is there, or what is, the underrated threat to strategic stability? What is the known unknown or the unknown unknown in terms of strategic stability for the Biden administration or for the next decade? Anything that you'd like to throw out there? Neil, we'll start with you and just Larry and Victor.
Well, it's almost certainly in the cyber domain. We've become, as a consequence of COVID-19, vastly more reliant on the internet than we were before, as a meeting like this perfectly illustrates. And so all the major corporations, all the major institutions of government are more heavily reliant than ever on information technology. And yet, we've ceased to be a dominant player in hardware, as I already alluded to. And the major preoccupation of the US military, you can see that if you look at Christian Broz's recent book, The Kill Chain, or a novel very popular in military circles, The Ghost Fleet. The great preoccupation in military circles is our vulnerability as a result of our dependence on the internet. And so I do think that what's going to happen in the coming year with the Biden administration is that people are going to say the following mantra: we have seen what a pandemic can do. This makes it all the more urgent to focus on climate change, which will be the next disaster. And we'll turn a blind eye to the fact that China's responsible for 48% of the increase in CO2 emissions since the Paris Agreement was signed. And as the policy community and as Davos and Aspen revert to discussing climate change ad nauseam and singing the praises of Greta Thunberg, the threat is growing of a major attack through cyberspace on our critical high-tech infrastructure. And I think that's the thing that's going to catch us unawares one day.
Thank you. Larry?
Thanks, Misha. I strongly agree with what Neil said. And I'm glad he mentioned Ghost Fleet, because it was the hard slap in the face, even though it was a novel that woke me up to what we were looking at. I strongly recommend it to our listeners. I think the likelihood, so I would say think asymmetric. If you're thinking of what's out there that could really, change the historical trajectory in some way, it's some kind of asymmetric assault or attack. And I think it's most likely to come from China or Russia, because even if it's asymmetric, states and resourceful states have more capacity to launch it. And Victor mentioned the potential danger of biological warfare from China. I will rephrase it that way. I think it's really serious. And I think ending our dependence, supply chain dependence on China in lots of critical areas is an overarching national security imperative right now. But in order to say something that maybe has been underemphasized in our time here, I'd say, don't think that the terrorist threat that we saw on 9/11 is just dead and over for all time. And I don't know what the unknowns are. I'm not imaginative enough to really define them. But I think we can discern what some of the known unknowns are. And the reason I think we shouldn't just walk away from Afghanistan and let it collapse is if the Taliban retake control of Afghanistan and think we're done paying attention to it, just exhaust it, and make it again a platform for attacking the corrupt, evil West, and particularly the United States, a state, any state, that is able to provide safe harbor for an ideologically driven terrorist group in an age of proliferating forms of asymmetric warfare is still a dangerous prospect.
This is exactly, by the way, a point that H.R. McMaster, our colleague, made at our first session on Monday about not underestimating the terrorist threat today, even after 20 years. Next year will be 20 years. So thank you for that. Victor, the underrated threat to strategic stability?
I'm worried both here and abroad that we have mortgaged our constitutional freedom and our avenues of action to big tech and people who are unelected. Just watching the testimony the other day of some of the masters of the universe. And what I mean by that is if I do an internet search and I put particular words and I can tell you that it's going to be massaged, and I can know which results will be put first and which second. I don't know any logic that I can hear about why certain ideas are censored on social media and why some aren't. There was no cohesive, consistent explanation. And when you add that to concerns about electronic voting in the United States and hacking, and then you look at our banking system as it vis-a-vis abroad, you get the impression that it's almost Mycenaean. And by that, I mean, you have a small elite that have expertise in how to run everything. And it's becoming increasingly non-paper. It's a electronic linear B, so to speak, language that they are doing. Nobody has any idea of how to code or to fix a voting machine or to wonder where your money went or how to stop. But they do know there's a lot of people ready to say, we do have it if you just entrust us with power and we're not going to be really accountable. And whenever that happens in history and you have a small Mandarin elite and they have the keys, they say, to your sophisticated good life, and they're going to be completely unaccountable, we know what happens next. And I think we're losing a lot of freedom, both because of the COVID and the lockdown, but also because of this computer-driven monopolies over knowledge and the accessibility to knowledge by people who, when we ask them to come before us and explain, cannot do that. They're not knowledgeable, they're not necessarily well-educated, but they're very, very confident. They're very sure of what they want. They're very wealthy, they're very powerful, and they're international. And I don't think they have the best interest all the time, in some cases, of what the average American in Des Moines or Flint, Michigan wants. And I'm really scared about it.
Thank you. We went a little bit over time. I trust you'll all think it was worth it. I'd like to thank my colleagues for truly a fascinating discussion. I know we could keep going for a long time. Larry Diamond, Neil Ferguson, Victor Davis Hanson. Let me remind you before we go, we have one more session in this series on Great Decisions, America in the World. That will be on Friday, December 10th. at 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern time, and that will be on SARS, trade, and T-cells with Mike McFaul, Lucy Shapiro, and John Taylor. So I'm Michael Auslan, and from rapidly darkening Washington, D.C., I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and we hope to see you again soon. Mm-hmm.